Yale Podcast Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Yale Law Journal podcast. I'm Sasha Dudding, the show's co-host. On this podcast, we'll be interviewing Yale Law Journal authors about their new and forthcoming work. We hope you'll subscribe as we dive deeper into current legal scholarship. We're very excited to bring you our first episode of Volume 129. We're joined today by Professors Dan Epps and Ganesh Sitaraman, who will be talking about their exciting and thought-provoking feature, How to Save the Supreme Court. Our guests argue that the Supreme Court faces a looming crisis of public legitimacy, threatening its ability to resolve questions of law with nonpartisan authority. To save the court, we must transform it, and they offer two novel proposals to serve as blueprints for court reform. Their feature will be published in Issue 1, available in October.
Dan Epps is an associate professor of law at Washington University in St. Louis. Professor Epps is an experienced Supreme Court litigator and a former law clerk for Justice Anthony Kennedy. He has written extensively on constitutional theory and federal courts. Ganesh Sitaraman is a professor of law at Vanderbilt Law School. Formerly serving as policy director and senior counsel to Senator Elizabeth Warren, Professor Sitaraman now centers his research around constitutional and administrative law. His most recent book, The Public Option, co-authored with Professor Ann Allstott, proposes to expand individual choice between the private sector and government alternatives, reducing inequality as a result.
This is Sasha Dudding. I'm a 3L at Yale Law School and the executive editor of Forum Features and Book Reviews.
And this is Sam Whipple. I'm a Features and Book Reviews editor and lead editor on this piece.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to be here. Yeah.
So what inspired both of you to write this article, and why now?
So I think what started this off is, you know, we were both talking during the Kavanaugh hearings and really seeing what was going on in the country among friends of ours on both sides of the aisle, and seeing just how partisan, how polarized, how controversial, how contentious the Supreme Court nomination had become. And you know, part of it was about Kavanaugh specifically and the hearing and the context of that. But you know, we both also talked about the fact that we had just been through another contentious, controversial, partisan, polarized hearing. And that was Neil Gorsuch's, based on the context in which Merrick Garland was denied a vote in the Senate, and then Neil Gorsuch got to get nominated and got into the Supreme Court. And I think part of what we thought about was how the confirmation has just become so toxic in a deep way, and the court has become so partisan and polarized. And this really seemed like a big problem and one that we thought increasingly might really threaten the legitimacy of the court itself.
And so, Ganesh, I just want to give you credit, because when I present this paper, I like to say that you're somebody who has what I call the Wayne Gretzky ability in scholarship, is that you see where the puck is going. And you really came to me and said, look, we really should get out in front of this. There's a lot to be said here. And you were right. I think we've seen a lot of engagement with our ideas. Not everyone agrees with us.
Definitely
as
true.
As we'll talk about later. But and so thanks. Thanks for encouraging me to start thinking more about these ideas.
Well, and I appreciate the hockey reference. I haven't played hockey since I was like 7. But, you know, to be the great one is really compared to him is really a big deal.
Now, you contend that this time is different. The court has certainly faced legitimacy crises in the past. So what changed this time around?
Well, I think what's different, at least the way we see it, is the way that the Supreme Court, the structure of the Supreme Court and the selection process is interacting with the extreme party polarization we've seen, which is fairly unusual in American history. I think that, you know, there's a very good argument that this is really the most extreme polarization we've ever seen in American history. And what that has created is the ability, I think, for political parties to try to capture control of the Supreme Court. And once that becomes possible, and this hasn't been true, even if you look back at other periods like the conflict that led to the court packing proposal of FDR, even in those periods, there was ideological battles in the court, but it didn't track party in the same way. And now the parties have sort of unified around competing schools of judicial interpretation. And once that's the way things start to work, once you start really having Republican justices and Democratic justices, you're left with a lot of really hard questions about why do we structure the system the way we do? Why is it that the rule is you have nine and whichever party happens to be holding the presidency and also the Senate, especially in light of what we might call the McConnell precedent most recently, gets to appoint a Supreme Court justice. But if those vacancies happen at other times, if somebody dies at a different time, that party doesn't get to make any appointments. And you know, you've led to – I think it's 14 out of 18 of the last appointments have been Republicans. That's just – if we think of the Supreme Court as an important lever of government power, that doesn't really make a lot of sense as a form of power sharing. And we need to kind of rethink the way the court works from the ground up.
So based on all these concerns, you offer two main proposals for reforming the court, and I'd like to just walk through a little bit each one in turn. The first is titled the Supreme Court Lottery. Can you walk us through what that would look like?
The basic idea, just to get us started, is that – instead of a court expansion plan that means one or two justices, we actually expand the court by about 180. Why that number? It's the number of judges on the Court of Appeals. So you appoint every judge who is a federal court of appeals judge to be an associate justice on the Supreme Court. We've now got a very big Supreme Court. And what you do is you have the judges on the Supreme Court, the justices, be chosen in panels of nine. And they would be chosen by lottery from the total group of Court of Appeals judges. We think that they should have a very small amount of time that they serve, so about 2 weeks at a time. That has some interesting benefits. It means that it's very unpredictable what kind of panel you're going to get. So if you're a litigant, you can't actually predict who the court is going to be that's going to hear your case. It also means that cases are heard under a veil of ignorance. The court that is taking cert in a certain case is not going to be the same group of people who's going to hear it. And that also reduces the opportunity for gamesmanship along ideological lines. So that's a quick overview, and I think we'll get more in depth as we go along.
Okay. And you call your second proposal the balanced bench. What does that one entail?
So the basic idea of the balanced bench is really kind of an analogy to civil arbitration. One very common mechanism that you see in private arbitration is each side gets to pick one arbitrator, and then those two have to agree on a third arbitrator, who often ends up being the deciding vote in contested cases. And that's just sort of the very vague level, the starting idea. And here, how that would be operationalized is you have 10 justices for starters. Five of them are affiliated with the Democratic Party. Five are affiliated with the Republican Party. You start off with this idea of power sharing between the two dominant political coalitions, Republicans and Democrats, in terms of equal seats on the court. But you don't stop there. Then there's five more justices, and they get picked unanimously by the partisan-affiliated justices, or what we might call the permanent justices, to sit for terms of 1 year, and they're selected from the lower federal courts. And the consensus requirement or a near unanimity requirement, we explore some of that variation, is designed to incentivize the justices to pick moderate justices to round out the court. Honest brokers, people who are not going to just vote in one predictable partisan direction. And our hope is that this system would create a court that looks not like just committed partisans versus committed partisans. There'd be at least a couple justices kind of in the middle of the court whose votes wouldn't necessarily track party affiliation.
So what distinguishes these two proposals from other past plans to reform the court, such as court packing or term limits?
So I think there are a few things. And part of this really gets to what we're trying to accomplish here. And there are some different criteria that we had when we started this. Why do you actually want reform, and what should be the criteria for a good reform proposal? So some of the criteria we started with are, first, that anything we propose has to be constitutionally plausible, even if it's not constitutionally perfect or ironclad or bulletproof. There's a lot of debate we obviously have these days about what's constitutionally allowed or not allowed. So you're not going to convince everybody about everything. But it needs to be something that has some sound constitutional basis to make a good argument for it. And part of the reason for that is it's got to be implementable by statute. It's very, very hard to get a constitutional amendment. We think that is probably much more challenging than even getting a statute on something as significant as reforming the structure of the court. So we wanted something that would be implementable by statute. A third criteria is that we wanted something that would generate a stable political equilibrium, effectively that would reduce the temperature of court appointments and the process, but would also be something that the other side could live with. So whichever side is pushing forward these reforms, Democrats or Republicans, we think it'd be most likely to be Democrats in the short term, that the Republicans would also be able to live with it even if it was pushed through a kind of constitutional or political hardball at the first stage.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction you just made in your very last comment, which is that we're not so naive to think that everybody's going to read our article and Democrats and Republicans are going to come together and say this is the path forward. We are envisioning a world in which, you know, maybe Democrats might seek to really change the process and they might do so on party lines. But we don't think it's crazy to imagine that maybe there's some kind of system that they could create that actually would have some purchase going forward. And you know, related to the question, I think a lot of the other proposals that have been kicking around recently, such as jurisdiction stripping, just more ordinary court packing, just sort of adding seats to the court for partisan reasons, we think those are somewhat less likely to lead to partisan, lead to stable equilibria. Court packing, that would provide some immediate sort of policy gains for Democrats because it would enable them to staff the Supreme Court with justices more to their ideological liking. But obviously the solution to that would be next time Republicans control the presidency and both houses of Congress is for them to pack back and on and on. Whereas we think that you know we should be looking for something that looks more like a good government kind of reform.
And what's the risk in sticking with the status quo? What if this doesn't happen?
Well, I think that one of the points we want to make is that that's just not possible. There is no way to maintain the status quo because something is happening. You're seeing – and that something could be a bunch of different possibilities. It could be Democrats actually try to pack the court if they get enough votes in Congress and they get the presidency back. But it could be a bunch of other things that are also destructive, which is just politicians trying to destroy the court's legitimacy. Politicians talking about the court as a partisan institution, maybe politicians starting to say we shouldn't follow Supreme Court decisions. There's a lot of possibilities that we think are as ultimately very destructive to the court's legitimacy, and we think that is a problem not just because the court is a good institution on its own, but because we see Supreme Court legitimacy as tied up with sort of the whole idea of legal legitimacy in our society, and we're kind of afraid of going down a path where we just see courts as partisan institutions. What does that mean for how people feel about law more generally? I'm not sure, but I don't really want to find out.
And this goes back to you know something Gann said at the beginning too, which is you know when you think about the polarization that's happened and how this example how today is different from the New Deal era or some of these other other periods where it wasn't solely on partisan bases that people were disagreeing. You know, just imagine what would happen if there was a Democratic House, Democratic Senate, a Democratic president who passes significant legislation and a court consisting of five Republican-appointed judges who are, you know, ideologically predictable, were to strike that down. You know, it's going to be very hard for people to say this is just law, and instead, it's going to be very easy for them to say this is all politics. And it's not politics; it's partisan politics. It looks very transparently partisan in that way. We think that's a problem because we should have a court that is distinct from just pure partisan politics. It's not good for the court's legitimacy, as Dan said. It's not good for the rule of law more broadly.
So how much leeway is there for change given that the court has been in more or less modern form for decades now?
So we think there's a lot of room. You know, the Constitution is a broad document that allows Congress to structure the government in a wide variety of ways in a lot of different places. We see that in administrative agencies, which are structured in many different ways. And the court itself, its specific structure is not dictated under the Constitution. There's a lot of room for the Congress to set that up both under its Article I powers and under Article III. And so we think that there's a lot of room. And really, if you think back over our history, we've had big changes in how the court was structured. So not just the number of justices, which has fluctuated over time, but for you know more than the first – for really the first century of our history. history. The Supreme Court justices rode circuit and in the early years literally rode around in horses to go to places to hear cases sitting on the lower courts. It's a very different system than we have now. That's a shift that's happened, and you know there's no reason why we can't see future shifts happen in this as well.
Now, Sam, though, I think your question maybe was getting at not just what are the formal constitutional rules, but your allusion to decades is maybe you're talking about what are the entrenched norms here? Is this even if we're right and we make arguments that we can talk about why this is constitutional, is this proposal just too unsettling of existing norms? To that, I guess I would just say, you know, I think we've seen a lot of norms unsettled in recent years, and I think that some of the other ideas that are currently actively being considered are probably more unsettling to existing norms. So I think that our system, the Supreme Court would look quite different than it has at other points in American history. But I think that it would be better than endorsing, accepting sort of just a straightforward partisan court backing system, which would really, you know, turn the court from an institution that obviously is, you know, very political in many ways, but really turn the court into a totally partisan institution. And that's what we're trying to avoid.
Now let's jump into the details of those plans a little bit more, starting with the lottery plan. Could you walk us through the mechanics, both from setting up the system and what it would look like in practice?
Yeah. So, as I said earlier, you know, part of the idea here is that what you'd have is every federal appellate judge would be appointed to the Supreme Court of the United States as an associate justice, would be eligible to be in the lottery for a panel appointment, which would happen every 2 weeks. The panels would sit for a two-week period. That's the cases they would hear would be the cases that come out of that period. They would also be able to take cert petitions during that two-week period. And then they'd go back home. After the 2 weeks, they'd go back home to wherever their chambers were. They'd finish writing their opinions. They'd work on that. It might take weeks. It might take months in some cases. But they'd be back home rather than in D.C. for that part of the job. Part of the benefit of this plan, as I mentioned, is that you know when you have that short time frame and when you have the lottery, the judges are not choosing their own cases and litigants can't game the system either because it will be unpredictable which panel you're going to see, who the specific judges are. Part of the problem that we face now is you see these briefs or arguments that are really geared towards who an advocate thinks is the swing justice on a particular question. And that means very idiosyncratic views in some cases can define the shape of the rule of law, how statutes are interpreted, or the meaning of the Constitution, which seems a little odd actually to us that we would leave so much to the idiosyncrasies of particular individuals. We think this actually will help push back from that a little bit. It also has the benefit of really making justices a little bit less of celebrities. When you have a system where people are lotteried in and they're only serving for 2 weeks, it's highly unlikely that these judges are going to be national figures who are media celebrities, have you know their faces on T-shirts or are cited frequently in MSNBC or Fox with praise or blame. They'll be a little bit more anonymous, and we think that's probably a good thing too for the court.
And you defend this proposal against a variety of constitutional criticisms. Can you walk us through some of those claims and your responses?
Sure. I'll just do a couple of them and let Dan jump in too if he wants to address a few of them as well. One of the claims that people make is that you can't actually have a lottery-based panel system because there is a provision in the Constitution that says you have to have there's reference to one Supreme Court, and there's a sense of a oneness of the Supreme Court, and that somehow panels would undo the oneness of the Supreme Court. I've always found this a little bit of a weird argument, and we make the case against it in the paper. And the reason why is there's still one Supreme Court as an institution in our system. It just has a fluctuating membership. And the real issue, I think, on the one Supreme Court that's going on is actually tied into when you go back to the debates in the Constitutional Convention, when you go back to the debates over ratification, is really tied to federalism questions. The idea that you know there wasn't a one Supreme Court under the Articles of Confederation. We were creating a single Supreme Court that would be supreme over the whole country rather than 50 separate Supreme Courts. So there's a oneness element there. And in fact, if you think about it, you know the personnel fluctuating on a Supreme Court is even you know not so concerning. We see this now. The personnel who are currently on the Supreme Court are not the same as the personnel panel that were on the Supreme Court even 5 years ago. Intertemporally, we see this change in the personnel. So the fact that there's different people doesn't undermine oneness in some sense. We already have different people constantly just because of appointments and new people coming in. So that's one of the arguments that comes up and that we deal with in the paper.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's an argument about the dual appointments clause, whether justices can sit on two different courts. We think that one's not particularly persuasive because that happens all the time in our current system. But one, you know, thing that people have questioned is the idea of a supermajority requirement, whether that would be unconstitutional. And we say we should have a supermajority requirement on the court for striking down federal statutes. There's a lot to say about that, but I think for now I just note that this is something that has been explored, proposed, debated, you know, talked about in Congress at a surprising number of points in American history. This isn't just some wacky thing law professors are coming up with in the 21st century. And I think that the arguments for why this is impermissible are actually hard. You have to have – there's nothing in the Constitution that says a court means majority rule. You'd have to say, well, it's somehow implicit in the original understanding of the terms or something like that. And I just don't think that that's persuasive to me.
And so if I can take us back to the public legitimacy point from the beginning of the podcast, the goal of this proposal and of the balanced bench is to restore that sense of public confidence in the court to be able to make apolitical decisions of law. Do you see the public as accepting these randomized panels and the decisions they produce?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, so the public right now accepts a certain amount of randomization in the law. I mean, so if you sue someone and you lose and you want to appeal that ruling, it's going to go to a panel that will be assigned randomly. And, you know, law professors will tell you whether you're going to win or lose that appeal is entirely dependent on your panel. If you have a good draw, you're going to win. If you have a bad draw, you're going to lose. And yet we just kind of accept this in a way that we wouldn't if you were to tell people, well, you're going to win if the judges are just going to get together and they're going to flip a couple coins. And if it comes up two heads, you win. Otherwise, you lose. People wouldn't accept that, but they sort of accept this idea of randomization in membership. That just seems to be something that's acceptable. I don't see why that shouldn't work at the Supreme Court as well. And I don't see how it's worse than the current system where the media says, okay, the five Republican appointed justices did this and the four Democratic appointed justices did that.
And I'd also add to that, you know, one of the places where the lottery approach brings additional legitimacy to the Supreme Court is that it allows for judges to be on the court and hear cases from a much broader diversity of geographies and backgrounds. You know, we have a court that's largely composed of people who went to the most elite, you know, universities, who grew up in a small number of places. Maybe Dan, maybe you know this, but is it that every borough in New York City is represented on the court? Or are
I
we
think
missing
not Staten Island?
Not Staten Island, but you know, most of the boroughs in New York City are represented on the Supreme Court. But you know, we have very few people from the West, from the South, from the Midwest. Very different geographies and different, you know, backgrounds and how people grew up. So, you know, part of the benefit actually is you would get many more people participating, including from all these other places around the country.
And more Supreme Court clerkships for all the law students out there. So let's turn to the balanced bench proposal. Can you walk us through how that gets set up and how that works day to day?
The basic idea is, as I said, you've got 10 permanent seats on the court. And those are going to be assigned in some way to the two dominant political parties of our age, Republicans and Democrats. And there's different ways we envision doing that. One possibility is having some kind of nominating commission that has specific instructions and then sort of gives names, and then the president is supposed to choose names from that list. Another is just to have a statutory requirement that says, you know, you can have the way that sort of independent agencies work, which is you can say no more than X number can be from the same political party. That's the sort of more traditional way to do it. But let's put that that aside for the moment. But you've got those 10, and then they are going to get together, and they're going to look to the lower courts, and they're going to try to find five justices they can all agree on. And here we say it's either it needs to be unanimous consent or at least near unanimous. If they can all agree on five, you have 15. Then the court has a quorum and it can hear cases. If you can't agree, court will just not sit for a while. and until you guys can figure it out. Hopefully they would have incentives to not go for the most extreme partisans. They would pick the kinds of judges on the lower courts who in this day and age would have no chance of being appointed to the Supreme Court, not because they're not excellent, but because they are ideologically unpredictable.
And there are a couple of unique constitutional arguments. Some of them overlap with the Supreme Court lottery. But with the balanced bench, there are additional concerns about the appointments clause and about First Amendment associational freedom. Can you take us through those arguments and your responses?
Sure. So, why don't I start with one, the associational freedom charge. So, you know, one of the arguments that the people make against this is, well, if you have to affiliate as a Republican or as a Democrat, this is a problem for your associational freedom. Maybe you don't want to affiliate as a Republican or a Democrat. And so there might be a First Amendment problem here with our structure. Our response to this is that you actually don't, under our plan, have to affiliate as a Republican or a Democrat to be a person in one of those, you know, slots, the 10 permanent justice slots on the Supreme Court. All you have to be is be chosen by the two parties to be one of the people in that slot. So in fact, right now, if you even think about it, you know, you could design a system where, for example, the Senate majority and minority leaders come together and have to agree on the names. And in that context, the Senate minority leader or majority leader would be thinking through the names, but the people they pick would not have to have any particular affiliation at all. If the Senate minority leader is a Democrat and wants to pick a member of the Green Party, they could do that. The Republican could pick a member of a Libertarian Party, and that would be acceptable too. The point is that the balance between the two has to be chosen across these. So that's one way of thinking about the design. As Dan said, there's different ways we've thought about the design. But the key part is it doesn't have to be that you yourself are a member. It's mediated through the kind of institutional choice structure that we've built out in the paper.
And because most, you know, sitting judges, if we're imagining someone who's a sitting court of appeals judge being elevated to the Supreme Court, aren't registered as party members. I think they're not supposed to because it's partisan political activity. So you could imagine operationalizing it in ways that didn't have that problem. You could say, well, no more than X number of justices can have been appointed by a president of the same party or something like that. That sort of gets at it indirectly. And I don't think that makes the associational burden any worse than our current system, where if you're somebody who has like a really idiosyncratic view of the law that doesn't line up with what Democrats want or Republicans want, you're not going to become a judge because who's going to appoint you? But I think that is a fair criticism if we say you have to actually be a card-carrying party member. But I don't think that's the only way to do it. The other one to talk about is the appointments clause. And again, you know, a lot of it depends on how it works. One idea we kick around is having some kind of nominating commission there that would just say sort of give the names to the president. And there are systems like that that we have like that. That's the way that judgeships for the territorial courts of the District of Columbia court system are divvied out. But in his quite good response to us, Professor Steve Sachs says, well, that's different. That doesn't implicate the same kind of appointments clause concerns because of their territorial courts. But I think the larger point is you see a lot – there are a lot of restrictions on – statutory restrictions on presidential appointment authority. So you see that with all these independent agencies, right? They say you can't appoint more than X number of members from the same political party. Well, that's a restriction on the president's ability to appoint someone. The Solicitor General is someone who by statute has to be learned in the law. You can't appoint a doctor to be Solicitor General. There's a lot of examples like that. And so I think you have to take a pretty hardline view of the Appointments Clause to say that Congress has no ability to pose some kind of limits on who can be named. Sure, maybe it can't say you have to name this person, but we think that there's a lot of flexibility there to impose some kind of guidance in terms of the kinds of people that are eligible for a position.
Assuming the balanced bench weathers all of these various constitutional points, how do you think people would perceive it? Would they see the Democrat and Republican justices as more political, or would they see this as sort of a less partisan court with the full 15?
So I think part of the hope here is that people actually see the court as more legitimate because of the combination of the 15. There's a representation of Republicans. There's a representation of Democrats. There's an element of people coming together to figure out other judges that are not particularly, you know, identified in this way in their exact appointment, and that combination will actually make the court feel less political. And so it's kind of an odd point in a way to make that it'll seem less political by making partisanship more salient. But in fact, that's the effect that we think it will likely have here.
Yeah, and I kind of got the feeling that we really were on the right track with this idea, where there was one week in which in the press we got criticized, this plan got criticized both for being too political. It would politicize the court too much. And then at the same time, we were criticized for being naive to think that you could depoliticize the court. And so I figured, okay, we're onto something here, because we're channeling politics to achieve a goal of depoliticization.
So I want to put the Supreme Court lottery proposal side by side with this one. What was your rationale in presenting two alternative plans rather than just advocating for one reform proposal?
So I think one of the things we were trying to do here, and you actually see it in each of them, is that we wanted to provide options. And part of the idea is that there's an ongoing debate that's happening on court reform. There's a lot of different things in that debate, and there's a lot of different places that debate could go. And you know, neither of us can predict the future in the sense of what might senators or congressmen or a president want to propose in 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years' time when something like this might become ripe. And so part of what we wanted to do was offer a variety of solutions and different flavors on them. So as you know, as we've talked about in each of these, there are places where we highlight, well, you could design it this way or that way, and here are the costs and benefits of each design. And that was part of the goal of the paper, was to provide a variety of these kinds of options instead of just one option. You know, I mean, obviously there's some benefits to being clear. I guess academics often provide just one option for something and stick to their guns all the way down, regardless of the consequences. But you know, if you're really thinking about what's useful to policymakers, as what we were trying to do in this paper, part of it is to have multiple options there, because you don't know what the political moment will fully how it'll fully emerge, and giving people a sense of the possibilities can be helpful.
Yeah, and I think when we first got together to write this, we sort of had the idea of thinking, oh, we can crack this, we can come up with the one perfect solution. And I think we really quickly realized, no, that's not the way it works. If this is going to happen, it's going to be part of a complex legislative process. And so what our goal, I think, really as scholars here, is really to kind of expand the idea space and to show you there's a lot more that we think is actually possible here than people are assuming. They think that there's a very, very narrow toolkit of possibilities. Actually, there's a lot of possibilities here. And maybe you're not persuaded by these two plans, or maybe you like some parts of them. Pick and choose. Take parts you like. Find something else. There's a lot that could work here.
And these proposals are already gaining traction among Democratic primary candidates, with Beto O'Rourke and Pete Buttigieg so far having mentioned it. Were you surprised at the quick take-up, and do you expect more to follow suit?
I was definitely a little bit. Usually you have a good day with your scholarship if you get, you know, another 30 SSRN downloads. So that was pretty cool. And I think it does really show you, and this goes back to why I was saying, Ganesh, you're the Wayne Gretzky, these issues are really going to be important to people on the Democratic side, because I think they're recognizing that not only does, you know, just the court matter, but that a lot of other things that matter that they might want to do, various kinds of further healthcare reform, things with immigration, really any kind of policy proposal that you can think of is maybe going to have to get through the court. Imagining the possibility that Democrats are able to get back into power at the executive level, they're still going to have the Supreme Court to contend with. And so I think a lot of those Democratic policymakers are really thinking about, God, we got to do something proactive here to deal with this, because otherwise this court is just going to stop us in our tracks.
So for 2020 and beyond, what impact do you foresee your scholarship having on the conversations around Supreme Court reform?
I think, you know, a couple of places where I think this will be really interesting. First is there, to the extent there will be some kind of debate, partly we hope that our criteria for reform will inform how people are thinking about any of their preferred proposals. If you're a supporter of the 18-year plan, if you're a supporter of court expansion, how do those measure up to the kind of criteria that we've put forward here? So I think that's a place where this might be helpful, even if people don't support the particular proposals that we've put forward. The other place, which is even more broad, I think, is, as Dan said, you know, we're trying to expand the possibilities of how people think about these questions. And part of what we've done, I think, well, or at least tried to do well in the paper, is also expand some of the possibilities on interpretation of, you know, provisions that have been around a long time. So, you know, thinking about one Supreme Court and what that means, thinking about the Appointments Clause, necessary and proper supermajority requirements. There's a wide variety of these areas. And in each of those areas where we grapple with the constitutionality, I think we're trying to contribute to conversations that happen in those specific literatures. And there's little literatures on, you know, each of these sets of provisions. So I think that's another place where hopefully our paper will have an impact as people think about those questions.
And as we start a new October term at the Supreme Court, how do you think these conversations around reform will end up changing the court and its jurisprudence?
I think I've said before, Chief Justice Roberts is an institutionalist, and you know, there's certainly, I think, a lot of people would suspect that he's going to care about the court's public image. And you know, does that mean he's going to vote differently in any really big cases? I don't know. Some people speculated that he did that in FIB versus Sebelius, the first constitutional challenge to Obamacare. Other people have disputed that account, that he was, you know, they said he was just, you know, voting what he thought was the correct view on the law. And I don't want to resolve that here. But I do think that in the broader perspective of history, there is reason to think that the court, you know, will try to protect its prerogatives a little bit by backing down from a full-throated conflict with the political branches. Now, I don't think all the justices feel that way, and I think that, you know, as we're recording, Justice Ginsburg is just recovering from her like 12th bout with cancer, and I think that if you imagine Justice Ginsburg being replaced by a justice who looks sort of more like Justice Thomas in terms of ideology, you actually might have a stable enough and big enough Supreme Court conservative majority that just wouldn't care as much about some of those impacts and institutional dynamics. But I think the Chief Justice probably does.
Yeah, I think one of the things that, you know, proposals and conversations in public have is that, you know, the outside environment shapes what goes on in D.C. and how people think about things there, whether that's the legislative level or the court level. And so I think part of what we're doing here with our paper and with podcasts like this and when people ask about it and what the presidential candidates who talk about it are talking about, or organizations like Demand Justice and other groups that are talking about this are doing, is creating an environment in which people are really thinking differently about these questions. And that changes maybe how the justices will think about it going forward. It changes how people in Congress are thinking about the importance of the court, the role of the court, the importance of appointments. So I think all of that elevates the conversation around, you know, we have a problem here and we need to really think about the solutions. And, you know, that shaping of the conversation we think is important regardless of, you know, which solutions in particular people pick up on.
All right. Well, that's about it from us. But thank you so much for joining us today. We've really enjoyed having this conversation with both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much. It's been fun.